Systems Administrator. We also have fall internships. Go to democracynow.org/jobs for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing team here in Berlin, Mike Burke, as well as John Hamilton and Dennis Moynihan. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Aaron Mattei, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I will be speaking in Visby, Sweden, on Thursday, on the island of Gotland, at 3:30 at the Church of Sweden. You can get information there. Also, special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, as well as Miguel Noguera, Julie Crosby, and Becca Staley, and Hugh Grant. A very special thanks to the Deutsche Welle team here for hosting us in Bonn, and to our team, Gerald Sanford and Gregor Holberg, Karim Zuna, Frank Buchholz, Anja Hook, Monty Kreiskother, Boguslav Reich, Christopher Schuttler, Alex Wagner, Sabrina Walker, Olive Wickoff, Sabrine Dubell, and Ralph Nolting. That does it for our broadcast. For the transcript, the radio, and the audio podcast, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tune in to KABU for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KABU will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio is looking for an IT contractor to work with our organization 15 hours a week at $25 an hour, providing on-site IT support as well as website maintenance support. Essential qualifications include at least 5 years of general IT network and server maintenance and website administration, experience with PHP, MySQL, experience in Drupal 6 and 7, ability to maintain rack-mounted server and maintain a local area network of Windows XP, 7, and 8 workstations. Send a resume and cover letter addressing the above qualifications and the question, why KABU is important, to hiring@kabu.org or drop it off for IT Hiring Team at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. More information can be found at kabu.fm/hiring.
This is 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis, K220 HR Hood River, K282BH Philomath.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Portland City Council prepares to vote on whether Airbnb rentals will be allowed in the city.
Israeli military forces escalate attacks in the West Bank and Gaza after bodies of three missing settlers are found.
President Obama moves to deport tens of thousands of children in a move originating from a right-wing political website.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, July 1st, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Amy Johnson. The data center currently under construction in the Dalles, Oregon, for the mega corporation Google is facing fines for labor violations. The construction firm hired by Google to construct the data center in the Dalles will have to pay a $20,000 fine for violating meal and rest periods between December and April. Google is spending $1.2 billion to construct three data centers in the north central Oregon city. Under the workers' complaint to the Bureau of Labor and Industry, 28 workers were denied breaks while they worked on constructing the facilities. KABU's Sequoyna Wright spoke with Brad Avakin of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry.
The construction company was found in violation of workers.
Workers in Oregon are entitled to get a couple rest periods during the day. They get 10 minutes if they're adults or 15 minutes if they're minors. Plus, you get a 30-minute meal period. And, you know, that's to make sure that workers get the breaks they needed in order to get something to eat and stay healthy and strong during the day. Also makes them more productive workers. And it's a violation of state law if an employer does not provide those meal and rest periods. And that's exactly what we found out was happening with this Colorado construction firm in Central Oregon. They were working their employees throughout the day without providing the meal and rest periods that they were entitled to.
What were the measures to find out that the construction were not in compliance of their of the law for their employees?
We were actually given a tip by the Iron Workers Union that this was occurring. We sent out a team of investigators to do actual site visits, to talk to workers, see what was going on the job, and check that against the employer's records. And it was clear from that investigation that, in fact, the workers were not being allowed the meal and rest periods they were entitled to.
And what will the company, what will the construction company have to do in order to get the penalties suspended? It says here that Boley agreed to suspend the $8,000 in civil penalties if the firm complies with Oregon wage and hour laws. You know, what will they need to do to make sure that happens?
It's a serious violation of the law to not provide a worker their rest or their meal periods. And in this situation, the out-of-state construction firm is going to have to pay about $20,000 in civil penalties for violating the law. At the same time, this firm was cooperative in the investigation. They have agreed to provide the rest periods in the future that they need to provide, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries will monitor that. But for now, they'll pay their civil penalties and start following the law.
And does Google have any other violations in Oregon or elsewhere in terms of where they've built their data centers? Has this happened before?
This case actually was not against Google. It was against one of the construction firms, an out-of-state construction firm that had been hiring workers and not providing the meal and rest period rules. It was not a case against Google, and Google does not have a history of treating its workers like that.
Okay. I am speaking with Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Land and Industries. Anything else that you would like to add, Mr. Avakian?
Workers should know that if they're on the job and working hard and they're not getting the rest periods that they're entitled to, that they can call the Bureau of Labor and Industries for help. And likewise, if you're an employer that needs help in just understanding the law, staying in compliance, likewise, call the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We're here to help you be successful too.
Anything you'd like to say in terms of union organizing?
Yeah, this case was a great example on how a union looking out for the rights of workers on the job, in this case the iron workers, helped provide the tip that led to the investigation even starting. And we give a lot of credit to the Iron Workers Union for coming forward when these workers needed the help.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brad Avakian. And this is Sequoyna with KBOO Evening News.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. No rerun of the U.S. war in Iraq. That's the message from U.S. Labor Against the War. The labor anti-war group says a majority of working people opposed the Iraq war in an eight-year struggle to end it. And it says the roots of the present crisis lie in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. U.S. Labor Against the War opposes any U.S. military intervention in Iraq, whether it be with missiles, planes, drones, bombs, troops, or any other means. U.S. Labor Against the War says when unions and other civil society organizations are allowed to freely operate in Iraq, the wounds of sectarian divisions there can begin to heal. U.S. Labor Against the War says there can be no military resolution in Iraq, and more U.S. military intervention there will only add to the suffering and prolong the hostilities.
We students, we veterans of the civil rights movement, we are here right now to demand that we want justice right now, right not now. Tomorrow, right now. We're going to create another Nissan. A Nissan that respects us as human beings, that respects our human rights.
Actor-activist Danny Glover at a recent rally at the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. The struggle continues there to unite the workers with a supportive community as they try to organize a union. The recent Freedom Summer 50th anniversary events included support for the Nissan workers who are forging a labor rights are human rights campaign. Joshua Dedmond is state chair of the Mississippi Student Justice Alliance.
This struggle is larger than the struggle in the workplace. It very much so resonates outside of the workplace, and vice versa. The community and students around the Nissan plant must do their best to advocate for these workers. So I think that the struggle is developing. I think it's getting stronger day by day. Are really attempting to reach the workers. There are workers now who are saying that no one has ever stood up for them in this capacity before. No one has ever worked this hard to listen to their discontent and to their plight.
The Laborers International Union of North America is calling for an investigation into possible use of child labor on a St. Paul, Minnesota construction site. A formal complaint was made Tuesday to both the U.S. and Minnesota Departments of Labor. Tim Mackey, business manager of Laborers Local 563, says a youth who appeared 13 or 14 years old was seen doing work on the Cornelia Elementary School in St. Paul on multiple occasions. Mackey says kids should be sitting in classrooms, not building them. The youth was spotted moving and placing concrete blocks and cutting blocks with a concrete saw without safety equipment or apparent supervision.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
On Wednesday, the City Council will hear public responses to the proposed changes to a law which allows Airbnb and other similar websites to operate in Portland. The changes in the proposal would make it mandatory for residents who wish to let two rooms or less in their homes to apply for an over-the-counter permit to share their space. The permit would be valid for 2 years. Residents would then be allowed to lease up to 5 bedrooms after review. This proposed requirement is much less stringent than requirements for bed and breakfasts. The changes in this proposal would create a new type of zoning rule called accessory short-term rental. Currently, the City Council has received responses from hotel owners who oppose Airbnb and similar services to exist in Portland because they don't pay the same taxes as hotels. Resident groups are concerned that allowing short-term rentals via Airbnb and other sites would be harmful to community trust, despite claims by these services that they build community by connecting people. The City Council has also received positive feedback about the new legislation from residents wishing to share their homes.
Portland City Commissioner Amanda Fritz held a town hall meeting last night at Cleveland High School to discuss the upcoming park bond measure. A recent Portland Parks and Recreation survey shows that residents support the parks replacement bond, which would increase funding for repairs in Portland's parks without increasing property taxes. Right now, property owners in Portland pay like 9 cents for every $1,000 of assessed property value for a bond measure that supports the city's park system. That bond was passed in 1994 and is set to expire this year, unless voters approve a replacement measure in November. Here's some highlights from last night's town hall.
You're going to be able to look back on this night and you'll say, I was at that meeting where we discussed the future of Portland Parks and Recreation, and we had a We had a great time, and that's where the effort began. So we do appreciate you turning out tonight. My name is Mike Abate. I'm the director of Portland Parks and Recreation. I want to turn this over to our commissioner, Amanda Fritz.
Just to be clear, we need $36.5 million is our annual projected need. So again, when people are saying, why aren't you figuring out what you need and finding a way to pay for it, we need $36.5 million, and what we have is $1.52 million. So the need is about 4%. We have about 4% of what we actually need. So we do have this amazing opportunity before us that I feel good about asking voters to see. I trust if we make the good case to the citizens of Portland that we have historically been very willing to invest in our park system, to build on the legacy that was handed down to us. The expiring bond that was done in 1994, which, by the way, in 1994 you got 194 really wonderful shiny projects, two community centers, multiple playground structures. I don't know if you remember that, but there was pretty much something in every neighborhood for that was really great. That's not what this bond is about, and I'll explain that later. But it's interesting to see how much you get with about $60 million 20 years ago and how much you get with about $60 million in 2015. The expiring bonds is 0.877 per 1,000 of assessed value. The replacement bond would be set at the same rate, and so that's why we're saying that it would not increase the tax rates, it would be at the same rate, and it would raise between 56 and 68 million. The reason that we don't have an exact number is it depends what the interest rate is when the bonds are put out as to how much you can then spend. So if you're currently paying this 8 cents per thousand of assessment, or nearly 9 cents, and that would go away next year. So if voters decide that they don't want to replace the bond, the taxes on a $150,000 median house would go down by $13 a year. As they won't, if the voters decide to go for it, then that decrease would not happen. And there's certainly a possibility that people will say $13 is $13 and we don't want to pass it. If that happens, we will see more closures like Cooch Park. For the past 20 years, we've been paying that rate of approximately 9 cents on every 1,000, and what we're proposing is to keep it at that level, just to continue the bond. So when you're doing a good poll, you don't just ask for all the good stuff, because we also asked about some of the issues like bathrooms. By the way, everybody knows that the bathrooms are bad. Even the people who love the parks, we know that the bathrooms are either not there or in sad shape. But we still wanted to ask a more representative question. We don't think that there will be an organized opposition to this proposal. In some ways, there doesn't need to be an organized opposition, because property taxes are high. We're just getting out of the recession. Politicians are scum and they waste your money. And we didn't exactly phrase it like that, but that was kind of the gist of, you know, you're already paying a lot. We should make do with what we had. That was the question that we put out to voters. Even after we tell that, we remind them that the city council will not be trusted with their money, the support only goes down to 65%. So I think that if we help people understand that tax rates are not going up, that we will have audits, and that it's the beloved Parks Department who is proposing this, that has an amazing track record of being good stewards of your money, that we do have a hope of getting it to pass.
And one question I had was regarding the repairs of public restrooms, for example, in Mount Tabor Park and on the west end of the Hawthorne Bridge, because when you want to go to the waterfront park, and that one is really, really, really nasty, needs repairing. And also the historic lightings in places like Peninsula Park, Mount Tabor, and others that have those historic concrete lighting fixtures, and cleaning those up. And is there some way we can work with PG&E and PP&L, for example, and have some kind of partnership on fixing those up? And how about the Parks Board having something to do with that? And I know we do some special fundraising for seeding the grasses in some parts of the Portland parks too, so something to think about.
My name is Som Subedi. I just want to know how we engage and involve refugee and immigrant community in this decision-making process.
The question was about engaging and involving all communities, and as I mentioned, we will definitely include the Parks Committees, the Coalition of Communities of Color, the Diverse Civic Leadership Partners, and surveys. And I didn't know we had a 38,000 mailing list. That's pretty exciting. So we're going to get much more information out to our many partners as we move forward.
That was Portland Commissioner Amanda Fritz speaking at a town hall meeting last night on Portland Parks.
The month of June saw 12 new locally owned businesses open their doors in Portland, according to Neighborhood Notes, a strong sign of economic vibrancy. The news also shows Portland's business climate is accommodating to small entrepreneurs. Five of the new upstarts were restaurants, from a Southern-style restaurant in the southeast to a gelato bar in the northeast. Over half of the dozen new ventures do not serve food, though. A rare sight in a city whose indie business landscape is stereotyped by outsiders as food carts. The Pearl neighborhood now offers a new independent clothing store along with a day spa, while a local coffee roaster has opened a second location in northeast Portland. Other new businesses include a bike-friendly backpack maker, an art gallery, a custom clothing boutique, and a whole body vibration exercise studio. While Portland's unemployment rate remained at 6.3% in the month of May, it has shown a rather steady decline since May of 2013, and the economic situation shows signs of progress.
Oregon State University experts announced today that a fungus is spreading throughout the Willamette Valley wheat fields. It's known as sharp eye spot because of the dark lesions it creates on host crops. The disease has appeared sporadically in previous seasons. The Capital City Press, however, reports that up to half of all Willamette Valley wheat fields have been infected by sharp eye spot so far this year. Yields of wheat could likely suffer this season, according to two OSU officials responsible for identifying and alerting farmers to the outbreak. OSU Field Crops Extension agent Nicole Anderson also claimed that researchers are investigating whether this year's abnormally dry conditions have accommodated the fungus outbreak.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Michael Whitney, one of the founders of the organization Micro Community Concepts, which focuses on building community for low income and houseless, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud will discuss the current situation in Uganda and the rules of LGBT rights in the country. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be much cooler with a high of 78 degrees, with decreasing clouds and a night low of 57 degrees. Today in history, President Barack Obama, during a visit to Tanzania, brushed aside aside sharp European criticism, suggesting that all nations spy on each other, as the French and Germans expressed outrage over allegations of U.S. eavesdropping on European Union diplomats. President Obama also attended a wreath-laying ceremony honoring victims of the 1998 embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya. The quote of the day is by Mahatma Gandhi, "A coward is incapable of exhibiting love. It is the prerogative of the brave."
It is 5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
President Obama has been hit with a firestorm of vitriolic criticism from Republican opportunists hoping to score political points by blaming him for the latest upheaval in Iraq. So I was pleased when finally one Republican spoke out loudly to deflect these partisan attacks. Thank you, Dick Cheney. Yes, he's back. The snarling, self-righteous, shameless old hypocrite wrote a nasty op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that was meant to skewer Obama on the Iraq issue, but it backfired. One, Cheney's attack was so vitriolic and personal, even accusing Obama of betrayal and being a fool, that it revealed just how mean and malignantly partisan Cheney is. More significantly, though, his venomous rant reminded everyone that, wait a minute, it wasn't Obama who made a ghastly mess of Iraq. It was Cheney and his imperious regime of neocon chicken hawks. The punchline in his op-ed was a haymaker intended to floor Obama. Rarely has a U.S. president been so wrong about so much at the expense of so many. But whammo, it was such a wild swing that instead of socking Obama, Cheney's roundhouse punch went full circle and smashed into his own glass jaw. Even Fox News, which had been a wildly enthusiastic backer of Cheney's war, roasted him over that line. Fox interviewer Megyn Kelly put it to him like this: "Time and time again, history has proven that you got it wrong as well in Iraq, sir. You said there was no doubt Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You said we would be greeted as liberators. You said the Iraq insurgency was in its last throes back in 2005. What do you say to those who say you were so wrong about so much at the expense of so many?" This is Jim Hightower saying, precisely right. So thank you again, Dick Cheney, for taking the heat off of Obama and putting it right where it belongs. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Kentucky has become the latest state to strike down a ban on same-sex marriage. A U.S. district judge today struck down Kentucky's ban on same-sex marriage as unconstitutional. Judge John Hayburn also said that cases of anti-gay discrimination require increased scrutiny. He challenged the state's argument that traditional marriages contribute to a stable birth rate and the state's long-term economic stability. Judge Hayburn said that those are not arguments that serious people would make. This is the same judge that ruled in February that Kentucky should respect same-sex marriages performed in other states. Today's ruling will be put on hold pending an appeal from the state's lawyers.
The school board trustees of Vancouver, Canada, have voted in favor of a new trans-inclusive policy to protect the rights of transgender students. The policy allows for students to be recognized by their preferred names and pronouns in school, including gender-neutral pronouns. It gives privacy and autonomy to transgender students as well. According to the policy, any communications between the school and a student's home will continue to use the student's legal name and their gender assigned to them at birth in order to protect that student's safety, unless the student permits them to do otherwise. It also enables transgender students to use the bathroom that corresponds with their gender and calls for the addition of gender-neutral bathrooms and changing areas in all the schools in the district. This policy is an amendment to a former policy introduced by the school board in 2004, which promised to support LGBTQ students and protect those students from discrimination based on their sexual orientations and gender identities in school. The revised policy is currently the most progressive move for trans inclusion in schools in both Canada and the United States. Two trustees of the Vancouver School Board acted out against the new policy by holding a press conference in which they claimed that real estate agents had warned that the new trans-inclusive policy would drive down property values in the city's west side. When the board trustees couldn't provide sources for their claim, they were fired. Vancouver School Board Chair Patty Baucus supports this policy in favor of student safety. According to Baucus, transgender students have a much higher rate of dropping out of school and attempting suicide or self-harm. She believes that the new policy will greatly reduce that number.
NASA has delayed the launching of a satellite which will measure carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, citing technical difficulties at the launch pad this morning. According to the space agency, there was a failure with the launching pad's weather suppression system, which uses water to dampen and prevent damage from the sheer volume of sound produced in a liftoff. The orbiting carbon observatory satellite, nicknamed OCO, will measure and map carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. Scientists intended to use OCO to track how the planet's forests, oceans, and soils absorb carbon dioxide, and whether current concentrations are affecting these systems' capabilities. The OCO is NASA's second attempt at such an endeavor. A previous mission in 2009 failed when the satellite burned up re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. The next launch has been tentatively rescheduled for Wednesday morning at approximately 3 a.m.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation has announced a new strategy to push for the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, to be allowed to enforce net neutrality. The group says that to get to a place where it can actually enforce neutrality rules, the FCC needs to reverse its 2002 decision to treat broadband as an information service rather than a telecommunications service. This is what's known as the Title II reclassification. That 2002 decision, as interpreted by the D.C. Circuit last January, currently prevents the FCC from truly promoting a neutral internet. 13-year-old blogger Charlie Dean recently posted a video online explaining the issue.
Hi! So if you've been listening to the news, like, ever, you've probably heard of net neutrality. Net neutrality is the idea that all internet traffic, no matter where it's coming from, should be treated equally. I mean, that's pretty reasonable. But unfortunately, the ISPs, people like Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, they don't think so. Hence all the commotion in news stories about net neutrality. It's actually a pretty big issue. It made the internet what it is today because startups like YouTube and Facebook could get noticed and become big. How are the next startups like that going to get noticed if they're being slowed down or blocked by Comcast or Verizon in favor of the bigger companies? Hint, they're not. So this is actually a pretty important issue. It doesn't really help that a lot of people making decisions about this issue don't understand technology.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
Series of tubes, you heard them. So for a while, we kind of had net neutrality, and that worked out pretty well. But in January of 2014, the FCC lost its authority to regulate net neutrality. So here's sort of the problem. Right now, the internet is classified as a Title I communication service. This is called an information service. That's like television, something being broadcast at you. That's probably not the best classification for the internet, which is why we need to push for... But that's probably not the best classification for the internet, which is why we need to push for the FCC to reclassify broadband services as Title II communication. Title II classification is stuff like telephones, where information's going both ways and both parties are contributing equally. The FCC would then have the power to regulate net neutrality, which would be good. Before the internet, people didn't have a way to share the things they make with everyone because it was just television, and television is difficult to get on. But now that the internet's here, any film student can share their terrible student film with everyone. And I think that's important. Everyone now has the power to share the things they make. But now the ISPs are trying to take that away from us, which is why we need the FCC to reclassify the internet. Okay, bye.
That was 13-year-old blogger Charlie Dean. Currently, the FCC has a set of proposed rules that implicitly endorses paid prioritization and special deals that favor large corporations like Comcast.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, July 1st, 2014. Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian in the West Bank and bombarded the Gaza Strip, causing injuries and damage. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian man was shot and killed on Tuesday by Israeli troops during an army invasion targeting the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Local sources reported that undercover soldiers of the Israeli military infiltrated into Jenin City and the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, shot and killed one Palestinian and clashed with dozens of local youth. Israeli soldiers assassinated Ibrahim Abu Zaga, 21, after they infiltrated into the Jenin refugee camp. Local sources said that the young man was returning home carrying food for his family to eat before starting their fast, as the Muslims are marking the holy month of Ramadan. Abu Zaga was instantly killed after being struck by several rounds of live ammunition fired by the undercover forces. Following his death, dozens of soldiers invaded the area and kidnapped three Palestinians from their homes. Elsewhere, Israeli troops moved into Hebron City in southern West Bank and forced the families out of two homes. The troops then placed explosives and blew the two homes up, according to witnesses. The homes in question were the residence of the two men who were abducted earlier in the day on suspicion of involvement in the killing of three Israeli settlers whose bodies were discovered Monday after having been missing for 18 days. The two men, Marwan Al-Kawasmi, 29, and Amir Abu Fisha, 33, stand accused of abduction and the murder of three Israeli settlers. Meanwhile, Palestinian medical sources have reported that dozens of residents, including an infant, have been injured and that at least two people were kidnapped in a series of military invasions into the southern West Bank district of Hebron late on Monday night and on Tuesday at dawn. Moreover, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Tuesday a young Palestinian man in the village of Hussan near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. The soldiers broke into and searched several homes and facilities. In the Gaza Strip, at least four civilians were injured when the Israeli Air Force carried out on Tuesday before dawn more than 34 airstrikes targeting different areas in the coastal region. The attack caused excessive property damage. Local sources said that the Israeli F-16 fighter jets fired missiles into different areas of the Gaza Strip, mainly in agriculture and open areas, in addition to several homes and civilian property. The army bombardment targeted Gaza City, Rafah, Khan Yunis, the central district, and the northern district of the besieged coastal region. Local sources added that Israeli Navy ships also participated in the attacks. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, July 1st, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Bassam Balnoura.
The Israeli escalation of the last 24 hours came after the bodies of three missing Israeli students, or teens, that were found near Hebron on Monday. At an emergency cabinet meeting in Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu claimed that the three teens were murdered by Hamas and that Hamas should pay for the crime. Netanyahu's verdict was rendered by no judge and with no trial. Multiple Israeli officials have called for vengeance, although no details have been released as to the circumstances of the deaths of the three settlers. One former Israeli parliament member posted a video on Monday that called Palestinian children little terrorists. The Israeli prime minister posted this on his Twitter account, quote, "Vengeance for the blood of a small child Satan has not yet created. Hamas is responsible and Hamas will pay," unquote. 34 airstrikes have already been carried out on the Gaza Strip, although there is no possibility that anyone from Gaza was involved in the killing of the settlers. The Israeli cabinet met to determine what actions to take in light of the deaths, with options ranging from intensive military operations against Hamas to the expansion of settlements in the West Bank.
President Obama has announced that he is taking unilateral action to speed up the deportation of over 50,000 children who arrived in the U.S. without their parents. The president describes the situation as a humanitarian crisis, but instead of classifying the children as refugees or asylum seekers, he is seeking to deport them. The Catholic Legal Immigration Network reports that many of these women and children are fleeing from their homes because of increasing violence from gangs, of which children are direct targets. The group argues that deporting children to circumstances that endanger their lives undermines our values as a country. They say we should be strengthening protections for children and families seeking safety, not eliminating them. Laura Carlson of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy spoke recently on Counterspin about the overtly political origin of the current alleged crisis.
This is a story that came out from political motivation. The story really starts in early June from a new syndicate called Breitbart in the Texas office. The reporter named Brandon Darby brought out these pictures that had been leaked directly to him, apparently from the Border Patrol, of children in these shelters under the headline that says, "Leaked images reveal children warehoused in crowded U.S. cells, Border Patrol overwhelmed." So they begin with this story with the interpretation already made, saying that, quote, the reason the children are leaving their home country is that they know they will not be turned away and that they will be provided for. So the story comes out ready-made to criticize Obama policies, make them look soft on immigration, and ignite an anti-immigrant backlash, which is unfortunately what's happened despite the fact that the story is being couched as a humanitarian crisis. And there are studies that show the U.S. Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees issued a report with 400 interviews, and we've talked to the shelters here in Mexico that are run by the Catholic Church for the most part, and the people who see hundreds of immigrants coming through a day and talk to them about the reasons that they leave are saying that almost no one is citing a perceived change in U.S. immigration policy as the reason that they're leaving their countries. What everyone cites are the absolutely unendurable conditions in their home countries. Some of the stories show this, but what they never talk about is the way that U.S. policies have contributed to the deterioration and almost the impossible conditions in Honduras especially, but also in Guatemala and El Salvador.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jake Randall, Rigel Hope, and Hillary Devaney. The producer is the amazing Sequoia Wright, and our engineer is Liam Delta. Woo. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Amy Johnson. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, guest host Lisa Loving speaks with Harris Zafar, Portland-based author of the new book, Demystifying Islam, Tackling Tough Questions. Harris Zafar is a lecturer, writer, teacher, and the national spokesperson and director of youth outreach for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community USA. At 9, the guest is critically acclaimed author and educator Mike Rose. He'll talk about the 10th anniversary edition of his groundbreaking book, The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker. The phone lines will be open. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news and radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's the KBOO Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a KBOO member? You can become one by going to kboo.org. kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
With the number growing in Portland's citizens who are experiencing being houseless, many agencies are doing what they can to meet the needs of those who are in need of a place to stay. KBOO's Sequoia Wright spoke with Michael Withy of Micro Community Concepts for KBOO News in-depth story about how Community Concepts is working to purchase land to be bought and owned by the people without help of the federal, state, or in some cases, even the city's help. Here's more on the story.
I am speaking with Michael Withy. He is one of the creators of Micro Communities, a new project that could possibly be set to be built as early as next spring, right?
That's correct.
And the organization that you represent is Micro Community Concepts. And Micro Community Concepts seeks to help those get housed that cannot afford regular market prices on housing.
Right.
And rent and all of that. So, Michael, go ahead and give some more information about micro communities and what's the concept behind it.
Well, we just took what already exists in Portland, the tiny house movement, and we picked a local builder of housing. It's called Techtwell out of Sherwood, Oregon. We kind of looked around at a couple dozen different models of micro homes that we could use, and we decided on Techtwell because of its its aesthetics. It's such a well-built unit, and it's got a kitchen and a bathroom. It's got a beautiful glass shower and a nice IKEA kitchen, and it's 200 square feet, and we can go ahead and put it up. It's a modular unit, so it comes on pallets, and then we put it together over a couple days. Just about anybody can put one of these together. So it takes a couple days to put it together. It lasts for six decades. It's about twice as thick and strong as a mobile home, a trailer. So people always ask me, well, not always, but they ask me, what's the difference between one of these micro communities and a trailer park? And I generally say that the walls are about twice as thick, and it's just a much sturdier building. So what we want to do is we want to start out with a pilot project, possibly in St. John's, maybe in the Northwest. We're still not decided exactly where the pilot project's going to go, but we'd like to put 25 of these units and rent them out for $250 to $350 a month. The criteria is going to be basically that, you know, we don't really worry about your credit. We don't worry about your rental history. We do want to make sure that, you know, we're not renting to, you know, child molesters. You know, it's just not really acceptable to the neighborhood. So we'll have to figure something else for that. But so we're looking at just having people that have an income from, say, $7,000 to $21,000. How the sliding scale works is from $7,000 to $14,500, I believe.
Now, is this a year?
Yearly income.
Okay.
So even a person just working part time at a minimum wage job could afford, you know, to rent one of these homes.
So how did this concept come about?
It came about through my introduction to one of these proposed micro communities, but they weren't really calling them micro communities. A guy that I know that founded Join, his name is Rob Justice. He introduced me to the brochures of these little Techtwell units about 2.5 years ago when we got the Occupy office. He was friends with Valerie at St. Francis where we rented our office space. And so he knew that we would end up working on the homeless issue. So he introduced me to this a couple of years ago. And I kind of went a different direction as far as protesting and went more at the systemic part of homelessness and low-income housing and gentrification, and really wasn't getting anywhere. So a light bulb went off in my head that we should be making these into micro communities and putting it together in a way that neighborhood associations would not only accept it but want to participate in forming it. And so we found that works. We actually introduced this to St. John's and to Lentz Neighborhood Associations, not just the board, but all the people in attendance, and got great reception from all those folks out there. So we decided to go ahead and go further with it. And we worked with a bunch of individuals and some business owners and some CPAs and some developers and came up with a plan that seems to work for everybody. So we, like I was saying, we have a sliding scale. It's 250 to 350. Folks making from 7 to 14.5 will pay $250 bucks a month. People making from 14.5 to 17.5, and don't hold me, you know, to the very dollars, but we'll be paying $300, and then over 17.5 to 21 we'll be paying $350 bucks a month. That is just rent. That's not including the water or the electricity, but for these small dwellings that we're talking about, very small bills for water and electricity.
So does Micro Community Concepts, do you all have a plot of land in mind in St. John's?
Well, we started out looking at a plot of land at 146th and Burnside, 105 Northeast 146th. It's nearly a half acre. And so we put the prices together for that. It's $350,000 for the land itself. And then by the time we get the sewers installed and get everything done, we're looking at about $800,000. And it's not that that's cost prohibitive at all, because it still would pay itself off in 15 years if we'd borrowed the money to do it. And so we'd still get 25 people in their own home for $250 bucks a month. So it does pencil out, but we found out lately that there's probably some interest from the city government as far as helping us out. And it's not firm. You know, we haven't signed any paperwork yet, and I haven't even heard from the mayor's mouth, but we have a meeting coming up in the next few days, and we're going to talk about some available plots of land that the city may be able to work with us on. And they're going to be spread throughout the city. I think you mentioned one in the Northwest. There's some in St. John's. And so the city owns property throughout the city. So,
okay. And so tell me, what type of residents would Micro Concepts be looking for in terms of, you know, livability and...
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
Well, we want to make a model. First of all, it needs to reflect the diversity of Portland. So we will try to match exactly the proportion of the population in Portland, and that includes everybody. So that's going to be the hard part of trying to fill one of these with residents that reflect the whole city. Secondly, we want to help families, we want to help veterans, we want to help seniors, and we want to help just everybody else too. So we're going to sort of divide it up into, say, if we have 50 units, we're going to put 10 units. They'll be double size, double units. Mm-hmm. They'll be for families. 10 will be for seniors that are on a fixed income. 10 will be for veterans that are on a fixed income. And the other 20 will go for, you know, couples and singles that are just working.
Now, does the concept of how much a family makes, so you mentioned earlier in this conversation about having a yearly annual income of 20,000 a year, right?
21 max.
Yeah. Does that apply for families as well, or is that for individuals?
Well, you know, that's a very good question too, because that's one that I don't hear very often. But families, we're going to treat families a little bit differently, because they're probably not going to, it'll probably be more transitional for them. So we want to keep the price as low as possible for a family. So the family units, which are double wide units, are always going to be 450. They're okay. Never going to go above 450, regardless of what the couple makes.
And you mentioned Central City Concern and TPI. How do they play a part?
Well, I'm sure they'll
How could they play? I mean, you can't really give an answer on that right now, but I mean, have you guys factored those agencies in?
We haven't contacted them. We've been working pretty closely with folks from Sisters of the Road and Right to Dream and Right to Exist and Dignity Village and others that are more hands-on, on-the-street type workers and volunteers. So we are partnered up with lots of people, if that's what you want to call it, partnered up. But we're certainly going to reach out to Central City Concern and all the others that are constantly getting a flow of people and that need this and that can fit this kind of criteria, which is not hard to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not trying to exclude anybody. We're trying to include everybody. And so we're going to be a little flexible when you know, we say 7 to 21,000, we will be flexible. That doesn't mean that you have to have made $7,000 that year. That means that you could have just got a job at McDonald's and you got a paycheck and it's $150, and I can just multiply that times 52, and that's how I'll come up with, you know, how much you make per year. So we are going to be very flexible about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so Charlie Hills supports this. Mayor Charlie Hills, he supports this?
You know, that's probably one of the most shocking things about this micro-community concept, is that the neighborhood associations, when we took it to the Lentz Neighborhood Association, typically with low-income housing, you know, they have a lot of questions and they have a lot of suspicions, and it's going to be really hard to get that past them. But at the Lentz Neighborhood Association, Jesse Cornett, who I believe is the chair of that neighborhood board, he called for a vote from everybody that was at the presentation when we gave it a few months back. And it was unanimous from everybody that was there to go ahead and explore further, to go ahead and move forward with this. And so I think once the city saw, and not just the mayor, but the city commissioners, I think once they saw that this was something that the neighborhoods wanted to see happen, that the a lot of people in the business community wanted to see happen, that was enough for them. And so Charlie Hales has championed it, actually, so far. After our last Wednesday's meeting with Amanda Fritz's office, her agencies in planning and zoning, we went ahead and went straight to the mayor. I did. Went straight to the mayor's office to do the next step, which would be to see how the city could help. And we had a short conversation. I had a short conversation with one of his policy advisors, and was notified that there's a good chance that there's some parcels of land throughout the city that we might want to look at and see what's the best fit. So that meeting's coming up in a few days, and that's going to be very interesting.
Really?
So you guys
are meeting with the mayor again in a few days.
Yeah, in just a few days, we're going to see what it was that they're, what they're proposing.
And you had mentioned earlier before we started this conversation that micro community concepts, it wants to do away with having to do anything with government. It wants to be completely sustainable, making sure that the money is funneled within the community.
Right.
And yeah,
exactly, because we think that the government spends way too much money on low-income housing. We think we could do a lot better job. We think that the right nonprofits and the right type of corporations, we're talking about B corporations that give back to the community. We think nonprofits that don't profit, and these B corps that give back are the way to deal with low-income housing, not the techniques they've used so far. For instance, micro community concepts in their bylaws, and they're still not written yet. We're a nonprofit, but we still need to file to get the nonprofit status from the federal government. But in our bylaws, it'll have written that no one makes more than $15 an hour. I'm going to be running it, and I'm only going to make $15 an hour. So, and that goes for myself. It goes for anybody else that's on the board that works full time. It goes for whoever's mowing the lawns at one of these micro. It goes for the subcontractors that come in and do work. Anyone who works on our property makes $15 an hour, and they make the same as the board members or anybody else.
Have you ever been homeless before?
Yeah. Yeah, I was homeless for several months at the protest at City Hall.
Mm-hmm. For Occupy?
Yeah, it was by choice at first, and then I delved so deep into the subject that I just kind of didn't even care.
Yeah.
Didn't even care, and so, you know, so technically there I did end up homelessness, and it was a good thing, because I think that if you're going to be compassionate about something, you really need to know what it is you're talking about first and experience it firsthand. And I got to experience it firsthand, and I'll tell you, it's not pretty. It's not pretty for anybody. And I know, speaking of Mayor Hills, I know that he wants to see, and I'm not praising Mayor Hills. Don't get me wrong. I'm not praising any politicians. What I'm saying is that from what I see now of what the politicians and the others, even the people in the Portland Business Alliance, people that we never thought we'd get along with, on this subject, we agree. And so I think that is why we're being able to move ahead so fast and so together.
Okay.
So, yeah. It's exciting.
So what's the next steps?
Next step is the meeting with Mayor Hales. We're going to see if there's not a bunch of strings attached to this land. We're going to see, you know, what it is they want and what it is that we can team up on. The next step for me is just waiting and see what happens at that. Of course, we're going to move forward with all the different getting the nonprofit off the ground, and we're going to continue with the business plan. We're going to continue on as if this isn't happening at all. But it's nice to know that it could be moved along a lot faster. It's yeah. So what's next? That's it. We're just going to keep moving forward with everything we've been doing and see what happens.
So do you think that there's a possibility that the grand opening could be in spring 2015?
I have no doubt that there's going to be a grand opening in spring 15. What I'm hoping for is something even better than that. What I'd really like to see and what I'm going to propose, which the mayor doesn't know, and you're the first one to hear it, is that we're going to take and we're going to propose that this land that they give us, we're going to try to get the biggest plot of land, even if it's even if you have to walk 10 minutes to a bus stop from, you know, on the outskirts of Portland. We're going to ask for the biggest piece of land, and we're going to offer to go ahead and get as many of these units that we can up as soon as we can this year. And if we if we can't for some reason, then we'd like to go ahead and look into starting our own type of relief camp, sort of like an AmeriCorps type. We're going to offer it. We're not going to demand it. We'll offer to do that for them. A lot of us have experience with the relief camp, so we won't just let that land sit all winter while we develop our plan. We'll go ahead and utilize it and get a bunch of people off the street this winter.
Okay.
Certainly.
Well, I've been speaking with Michael Withy of Micro Community Concepts, and there's a possibility that there might be micro communities springing up here in the Northeast St. John's area. And where can our listeners go to, you know, get more information and see what they can do to help contribute or volunteer?
Well, you could go to Micro Community Concepts. We have a website. The website, we're still working on the website. We're still all volunteers here, so nothing moves fast.
Right.
But there is a website, microcommunityconcepts.com.
Okay.
And we also have a Facebook page where we try to keep everybody up to date with our meetings wherever they are.
Okay.
And there's also some links to the TechDwell units, and there's some nice pictures that you can look at and get a lot more information about how it is that one of these would run. So Micro Community Concepts, Google it up. You can watch, you know, a coin interview. You can see the Willamette Week a couple weeks ago, the article that went in. You can go to the Facebook there, and you can go to the website from there.
Okay. Thank you, Michael, for coming into the KBOO Community Radio Station studios. And I'm Sequoia Wright for KBOO Evening News.